from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually to meet workforce demands and grow West Virginia's economy. Learn more at wvhepc.edu. The W. Page Pitt School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Marshall University, providing hands-on education in advertising, public relations, and journalism across all media platforms.
At the legislature today, members of the Senate react to the downgrade of the state's bond rating and discuss its impact on upcoming budget talks. In the House, delegates consider a plan to reorganize the state vehicle fleet. And we dig into the state's education system coming up on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. Governor Jim Justice announced during a press conference at the Capitol yesterday that the state's bond rating had been downgraded by the third national rating agency in a year. Moody's dropped the state's rating from AA1 to AA2. With the downgrade, Moody's also issued a warning for the state, advising the governor and legislative leaders to look for ways to fix the structural imbalance in the state's budget and incite long-term economic growth. Today, lawmakers reacted to the announcement and the warning, which the governor used to promote his plan to increase taxes.
The bond market is a complicated area of finance that a lot of people, even a lot of lawmakers, have difficulty understanding. Senate Minority Leader Roman Prezioso is a former finance chair and says the bond rating is like a credit score. When the rating is high, the state gets a low interest rate on long-term loans that it takes out for expensive projects, like building highways or expanding public water lines.
But as our bond rating lowers, the interest rate goes up. So it puts a lot of projects, infrastructure projects, in jeopardy.
It affects the current budget to a degree, Prezioso says, but it has a larger impact on the future ones. Even after the announcement, though, and the warning by Moody's to find a long-term solution to the state's continually imbalanced budget, Republican legislative leaders are sticking to their guns on cutting government and avoiding tax increases. In a written statement Wednesday, Speaker Armstead said the downgrade reinforces the need for fundamental changes to how government operates and that the tax and spend policies of the past won't solve the problem. Today, Senate President Mitch Carmichael agreed.
There are things that we can do in this legislative session that will reverse that trend and put us on a path of growth and prosperity. And those are the things that we are intent on pursuing.
Things like reducing the size of government and creating a business climate that incentivizes growth, Carmichael says.
The bond agencies don't care how much government you have, it's your ability to pay for it.
Prezioso says he sees only one solution.
The situation that we're in now, it almost mandates that to stabilize this economy, we need a revenue source. And that's about the only way you can do it.
But that's something lawmakers in recent years have been unwilling to do, and not just under Republican control. Democratic Senator Corey Palumbo says the tax and spend policies Speaker Armstead referred to haven't been implemented in his 15 years in the legislature.
That's not been the way of the legislature. We've increased the tobacco tax twice in the last 20 years that I can recall. And that's been the only tax increase that we've passed in this legislature.
State budget officials have predicted a nearly $500 million budget gap in the 2018 fiscal year, but Republican Senator Craig Blair says that gap is in the governor's version of the budget, a budget that's built on increased spending supported by tax increases.
He's brought before us the largest budget that we've ever had. He's also brought before us the largest tax increase that we've ever had. And I can tell you right now, my vote is not going to be part of that.
That's why Senate leaders like Finance Chair Mike Hall say they're handling the budget differently this year. Hall's committee is meeting with individual agency heads to find potential cuts and efficiencies. And instead of building a budget based on the money the governor predicts the state will have next year, they're building it off of the revenues the state actually brought in this year.
We know roughly how much money we took in last year and how much we have to spend. We want to build a budget document around that.
Only after they have that spending document complete, Carmichael says, will his chamber look to any potential tax increases. Carmichael expects the Senate's budget document to be completed around the halfway mark of the session.
Both the governor and members of the House seem to be on the same page when it comes to state vehicles. They want fewer cars and a better system to track them. That's what a House bill discussed in committee today would do, Liz McCormick reports.
Members in the House Government Organization Committee took up a single bill this morning, House Bill 2004, to create and maintain a centralized state vehicle inventory system. Under the bill, the data and information regarding state vehicles would be housed in the current Fleet Management Office and would distinguish state, county, and city vehicles with different color plates, much like the system West Virginia has in place today. The problem is that system hasn't been working the way it's intended to. Republican Delegate Pat McGeehan of Hancock County questioned Adam Fridley from the Legislative Auditor's Office.
How many cars, how many vehicles in total does the state government own?
In earnest, no idea. When we conducted the audit, we got three data sets. We got from BRIM, we got from the Division of Motor Vehicles, and we got from Fleet Management Office. The numbers range from 7,600 to 12,600.
7,600 to 12,600?
Yes, sir. Now, the Division of Motor Vehicles included all green license plates. That was 10,504 vehicles. Not all of those are state cars, but the data sets did have fairly significant discrepancies.
Those green license plates are how state vehicles are identified, but the problem is organizations that are considered quasi-state agencies, such as community senior centers or public service districts, also get green plates even though the state doesn't technically own them. House Government Organization Chair Gary Howell is the bill's lead sponsor.
When the state can't answer a question of a $200 million plus asset, how much it's actually there, we got a problem, so we started looking into it. And for the past roughly 10 months, we've been working on this with Fleet, DMV, and BRIM, trying to come up with a solution.
Howell says he and other members have also worked closely with the governor's office in drafting his version of the bill. He says the state hasn't been tracking the vehicles very closely, and considering the state's budget crisis, Howell says reorganizing the system, or essentially starting the count from scratch, will help.
It won't help the budget this year, but next year, we can. Once we get a number, we're going to be able to look at this and say, here's some serious cost savings. I expect to save tens of millions of dollars in the subsequent years by getting control of the fleet.
Bob Ashley, who was previously a member of both the House of Delegates and State Senate, is now the governor's legislative director. He says having so many quasi-state agencies with green-plated vehicles has posed a real problem that he says is addressed in another version of the bill presented by the governor. That bill would also create a new vehicle registry and change the plates issued to non-state agencies.
If you're a state vehicle, you're a green and white license. If you're a quasi-state vehicle, you're a black and white license. And the people will know the difference on the road.
The two versions of the bill, from Delegate Howell and from Governor Justice, are very similar, but the committee voted to advance the legislature's version of the bill. Ashley says creating a reliable tracking system for state vehicles will save West Virginia taxpayers money.
We're going to run more efficiently. The vehicles, fleet management will keep an eye, and they do, but they will have increased to look at the gasoline, the usage, the wear and tear, when the vehicle's been serviced, it will become a maintenance. They will also have a better maintenance program for all the vehicles. It is really tightening up to make certain for the taxpayer that what vehicles are owned by the state will in fact be taken care of and recognized by the state.
So far this session, five bills have been introduced on behalf of the governor, but Ashley says a total of 29 are expected. For the legislature today, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Senators approved a bill that makes changes to who is eligible for unemployment benefits in the state today. Carol Lofton reports the bill that was up for a vote is receiving pushback from state labor leaders.
Senate Bill 222 was put to a final vote in the Senate today. The bill clarifies existing law to make sure that workers who voluntarily go on strike during a labor dispute cannot receive unemployment compensation. workers who are locked out of their jobs or who are permanently replaced by their employers are still able to claim unemployment under the bill. Senate Judiciary Chair Charlie Trump explained on the chamber floor that state law currently prohibits workers who strike from receiving those benefits. But the practice hasn't been clear.
That we have received a fiscal note on this bill, and the fiscal note says that if we pass this into law, we're going to save $176,000 and some dollars in fiscal year 2018, which I interpret to mean that the state believes, workforce believes, that we have been paying workers unemployment benefits while they're on strike.
Democratic Senator Mike Romano says the bill doesn't just clarify the current law, though. It also takes away some of the authority of the Bureau of Employment Programs commissioner. That commissioner decides whether a worker is on strike or has been locked out of his or her job and therefore is eligible for benefits. He questioned Trump.
We're taking that discretion away from the commissioner.
One of the purposes of the bill is to eliminate some of the discretionary judgment that a commissioner has and to try to define what is a strike, what is a lockout, and not have it be subject to someone's arbitrariness or discretion.
Trump says that's the legislature's job, to properly define the law. In this case, so that the commissioner has guidelines to follow when making a decision on unemployment eligibility. But union groups in the state are already speaking out against the bill, including the AFL-CIO. Josh Sword is the union's president.
The idea behind negotiating contracts and collective bargaining agreements is that both the employee and the employer sit down on equal standing, on equal ground, so they can debate and negotiate a fair contract. This just tips the scales toward the employer and makes it much more difficult for employees to get a fair deal when they're negotiating a contract.
Sword thinks the legislation is an overreach and is actually interfering in the labor negotiating process. But Trump points to the state's workforce participation rate, which is one of the lowest in the country.
To me, it's a question of, are we going to make sure that the premiums, the money that's paid into that unemployment compensation fund by taxpayers, employers, is preserved for the people whom we all agree truly deserve it because they've been laid off or riffed? Or are we going to have an administrative judge paying out benefits to people who voluntarily walk off their job and go out and strike and set up a picket line? And I say no. We don't have the luxury to spend those unemployment benefits to subsidize that sort of labor activity.
But Sword maintains the bill will only hurt working families. The Senate approved Senate Bill 222 on a party-line vote, with one senator absent. It now heads to the House of Delegates. For the legislature today, I'm Kara Lofton in the Senate.
The chairs of the House and Senate Education Committees join us, but first, we meet three more members of the West Virginia Legislature.
Mitch Carmichael is the president of the West Virginia Senate. He is a Republican from Jackson County and represents the state's 4th senatorial district. Senator Carmichael was elected to the Senate in 2012 after serving 6 terms as a member of the House of Delegates. He's a graduate of Marshall University. Rick Atkinson is a Republican representing the 11th House of Delegates District. He was appointed to the House of Delegates by former Governor Earl Ray Tomlin in 2015 and won re-election in 2016. He's from Roan County and is a graduate of West Virginia University. Steve Westfall is a Republican from Jackson County. He represents the state's 12th House of Delegates District. Delegate Westfall was first elected to the House in 2012. He serves as the insurance chairman of the Banking and Insurance Committee and is vice chairman of the Committee on Enrolled Bills.
Although the budget has been the top priority for lawmakers this session, its implications trickle down into all areas of state government, including education. Joining me to discuss the state's education system are Senator Kenny Mann. He's from Monroe County, and this is his first term in the Senate, and Delegate Paul Espinosa, a Republican from Jefferson County. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Let's start with the budget. There's been some talk at the State House about reducing what's called the state school aid funding formula. Now, the formula itself is very complicated, but it's essentially the amount of money that the state sends to each county per pupil, per student. And there's been some general talk about reducing that funding. It's kind of scaring some people out there in the public. Delegate, let's start with you. Do you think that's possible to see this year, reductions to education money?
Well, Ashton, when you're facing a $500 million budget gap, and when you consider that education comprises such a large percentage of our budget, you know, no agency or no entity, including education, I think can be, you know, totally off the table. And certainly, we've been looking very closely at how can we help our education institutions, both K through 12 and higher education, be as efficient as possible so that they're using taxpayer dollars wisely. And much of the legislation that we are contemplating this legislation is really aimed at providing additional flexibility so they can do just that.
Senator, should people be worried that their schools are not going to receive enough money?
Well, and I would mirror the Delegate Espinosa's words there. I would just say that as of right now, we're looking at all options. Of course, no one wants to see any cuts in any place, you know, education or what have you. But we're just going through each line item. And at this point, I would say for myself, no. I wouldn't want anybody to get in panic mode just yet. But definitely you have to look at all. I think our goal is right now with education is, like he said, the flexibility. It needs to be there. And at the same time, boost morale across the state.
Well, I'd like to talk about some of those specifics because I feel like we hear those terms at the State House a lot. Flexibility in local education or more local control at the county or in the classroom. What does that mean exactly? Delegate, how do we do those kinds of things?
Well, we took up legislation today, House Bill 2524, that in many respects, is based on that premise of let's provide as much local decision making as we can. House Bill 2524 really deals with how we provide professional development for our educators. And, one of the recommendations of the governor's education efficiency audit, Governor Tumlin's education efficiency audit that was commissioned back in 2012, was that our local principals really should be the instructional leader of their schools. They should be collaborating with educators to determine what type of professional development we need. And so House Bill 2524, one example of how we want as much decision making and as much flexibility to be made at that local level, rather than continue to pursue this top-down approach that many of our educators are frustrated with.
Senator, is there any specific legislation that's coming through your committee that does the same thing, allows this flexibility, or pushes local control down?
Sure. There are several things out there. What we're looking for right now, and just like he said, you were there today and saw the on a Senate Bill 242 that was the school calendar bill, and putting it through. It's the little things like that, all the way down to the little things like that, that gives control back to that county, because every county is different. And with tweaking that just a little bit and giving what unanimously passed last year from the 180 days back to the minutes, some areas have more snow than others and so forth. So different things come up. So even down to that flexibility over to, as we was talking earlier about flexibility and local power with the spending, with say the school buses. You know, some counties need the school buses right now. Some don't. Well, there's funds out there every year for to purchase the school buses, and you know, it's a. I think that the for the counties that don't need a bus this year, if they could use this funding in another source, you know, give them that flexibility to, you know, within the limits there. So I think that'll help out our systems quite a bit.
Yeah, let's talk about that bill just a little bit that was passed in the Senate today, the school calendar bill. It essentially takes out that word separate. 180 separate days, and goes back to just 180 days of instruction. Delegate, that bill is now going to be coming your way, I assume. Do you have any issues with it, or you think it's a good piece of legislation?
Well, I haven't actually seen the specific piece of legislation. To the extent that it's similar to last year's legislation, I guess while I'm supportive of providing additional flexibility and allowing our school systems to meet the 180-day requirement, one thing that I don't want to see, and I'm hopeful that the legislation would not include this, was a provision that was in the bill last year, ultimately vetoed by Governor Tumlin, that would have, in some respects, reduced the flexibility that our local counties have. And I'm speaking specifically of the start and stop dates, you know, for school calendars. Under Senate Bill 359 that was enacted several years ago, counties have a great deal of flexibility to decide what makes the most sense for their local school districts. If a county wants to start a little earlier to ensure that they're able to complete their first semester by the winter break, they can do that. They could start a little bit earlier in order to have several additional breaks during the first semester. The legislation that was vetoed last year would have restricted counties from when they could start their school year and when they had to complete their calendar. I certainly would not be prepared to support legislation that in any way is going to reduce the flexibility that we've provided counties. But certainly we'll take a good look at that. We do have several pieces of legislation that have been introduced in the House. I believe the governor, from what I understand from talking with his staff, does intend to send us a bill as well. So we'll certainly want to take a look at the governor's ideas and see how we can come to a good piece of legislation that provides flexibility but doesn't overly restrict our counties.
Well, one of the governor's ideas is, of course, to give teachers a 2% pay raise this year, and that accounts to about $800 per teacher. It's not much, but he's got it in his budget proposal. Senator, you also sit on the Finance Committee. Is it possible to make that small pay raise happen?
Well, we're definitely going to take a look at every option at this point. You know, the cause and effect on every single item on this budget is crucial, and absolutely, I can tell you, there's not a soul in the Capitol, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter, that doesn't want to see that happen. Now, and as I've said many times, in this budget situation, that it's not shameful to be poor. It's just inconvenient, and right now, that's where we're at. It's inconvenient, and I do believe we're going to get over this hump. And that's why you always see, in such as the calendar bill, putting items in there to give the flexibility and show a morale boost. I said earlier that what we can't afford to pay you at the current time, what we can't afford to pay your worth at the current time, I always do everything in my power to back it up with appreciation. So that's why several of these little issues, little items in our bills are looking for that. So yeah, we're going to look and explore options and see everything we can do to get there. So that's where we're at right now. So.
Delegate, we've got less than a minute left, but I'd like to hear your thoughts. You're also a Finance Committee member. Can we get that pay raise through?
Well, representing a district in Jefferson County that is surrounded on three sides by Virginia counties, I certainly appreciate the need to try to make our teacher compensation, you know, more competitive. We certainly continue to struggle with not only attracting quality teachers, but then retaining them, you know, with those substantially higher salaries just across the border. I certainly was pleased to support the last teacher pay raise that we did, and also for our school service personnel. I support the governor's proposal to try to make our pay more competitive. Unfortunately, the governor's proposal relies pretty much on significant tax increases, for which I don't see a lot of support in the House or the Senate. So we'll really have to look at that in terms of the overall budget to see if we can identify funding to help us make our pay more competitive.
Delegate Espinosa and Senator Mann, chairs of the House and Senate Education Committees, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on the Legislature Today, we're joined by the chairs of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees to discuss the legislation their members will consider this session. Senator Charlie Trump and Delegate John Schott join us tomorrow. And remember, you can watch the Legislature at Work live every day on the West Virginia Channel. Tune in at 11 a.m. to watch the House and Senate floor sessions or catch them as they're rebroadcast each evening at 7. That's on the West Virginia Channel or streaming live on our website, wvpublic.org. This has been the Legislature Today. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following.
AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Online at aarp.org/WV. West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working to double the degrees produced annually to meet workforce demands and grow West Virginia's economy. Learn more at wvhepc.edu. The W. Page Pitt School of Journalism and Mass Communications at Marshall University, providing hands-on education in advertising, public relations, and journalism across all media platforms. From West Virginia Public Broadcasting.